There is a distinct possibility we've found our man. The words of the head of the Canberra Criminal Investigation Division, the CID, Detective Inspector Reg Kennedy, almost 3 years after 20-year-old Karen Rowland went missing on the night of February 26, 1971, from alongside a lakeside thoroughfare at the heart of the Australian capital. May 13, 2021 marks the moment 50 years ago when her skeletal remains were discovered in the Fairburn Pine Plantation on the city's northeastern outskirts. In the shadow of that bleak milestone, and with the words of Inspector Kennedy echoing in my mind, new information was recently presented to me firsthand, revealing a potential confession on Karen's fate from as far back as 1973. Said to involve a convicted killer serving a life sentence in Goulburn, who was residing in Canberra in 1971, a name that would become known to the Rowland family. Held tightly and in-house for near on five decades, it was shared with me as a clarion call that this latest scenario warrants much closer scrutiny in a modern investigation. Alternatively, at the least, a more defined response from those who have the greatest likelihood of being, as they say, in the know. I'm Nicole Overall, creator and host of Capital Crime Files, and this is another case file fragment, essentially snapshots of some of the most up-to-the-minute developments as they're occurring in the course of my attempt to unravel and fully document what befell the almost five-month pregnant receptionist on that summer night of so long ago. My chance to share with you too some of my musings as I try to logically bring together the myriad pieces of this bewildering puzzle. Although I'm still delving into these current rather startling admissions in order to provide the most accurate assessment possible, and which will be dissected at greater length in upcoming episodes of Season 1, at this point I can disclose it's the outcome of a lengthy interview with a highly credible source. Again, as throughout this podcast, in order to maintain privacy and in consideration of the consequences in the hopeful event of a trial, both he and other parties will remain nameless. The gentleman whose more than two decades-long notable career path saw him intimately acquainted with Karen's and other cases from the outset contacted me due to this work and my regular accompanying features in the publication and supporter of the endeavour, Canberra City News. So has there been an expression of disappointment at a lack of either the advancement or qualified discounting of what he believes to be most significant elements, and for this to be done in the public domain. He feels the reason it hasn't occurred before now can largely be attributed to the inevitable revolving door of those assigned to investigate, given the time that's elapsed. Certainly what the well-placed informant has shared with me seems to marry with the limited information on the record, most of which was not part of the brief he still retains. His compilation instead a result of hands-on involvement and recollections. Aspects of it have also previously been reaffirmed during my interviews with the Australian Federal Police, AFP, in their review of Karen's cold case. Equally, did all of this converge with the release of Episode 5 in this podcast that explores salient points to arise from the two-day coronial inquest as 1971 drew to a close. Among these was the strong suggestion that Karen, alive or dead, was dragged from a vehicle to the position in which she was found. So does it come in the wake of the recent Australian TV show on the potential for convicted serial killer, the now dead Ivan Milat, to be connected to various unsolved disappearances and deaths in the immediate orbit of the nation's capital. A question put to me frequently since, did he do it? These fast-developing imputations would appear to throw a whole toolkit in the spokes of that ever-turning wheel. Most are aware that the recognised image of what could be his disembodied head, all teeth and receding hairline, as he leers from the backseat of a police car, becomes media wallpaper whenever a cold case on the missing or murdered gains some attention. Many, both those with a general interest and professionals in the field, believe it's a long bow to draw in trying to link Malat to various Canberra region cases, particularly Karen Rowland. In this 1973 instance, he has definitively been ruled out as the person in the police sights. He'd faked his suicide attempting to avoid a charge of rape in April 1971, slinking his way to New Zealand until early 1974. Beyond doubt is that this most recent turn of events pinpoints numerous yawning gaps in Karen's tragic narrative. There are also, though, tiny, possibly misleading side roads, from timings to the identification or even misidentification of any who may be linked, particularly in view of limited corroboration. As such, unpicking the finer points elicits a degree of frustration, with a reliance predominantly on aging memories and often inexact media coverage from the day. What's been discussed with me highlights the paucity of coverage following the conclusion of the coronial inquest in October 1971. If following it through the media only, easy to think the case file was thereafter shelved to collect dust and cobwebs. At that pivotal moment, it remained one of only two unsolved prospective murders in Canberra, the other that of six-year-old Alan Redstone from 1966. It doesn't actually take long for them to be relegated a cold case. While the definition among agencies varies, as a general rule, if eluding an outcome and in the absence of anything deemed new or when leads have been exhausted, it can be within a year, sometimes less. In a sobering statistic, in a 2019 paper by Claire Ferguson and Amber McKinley in the Journal of Criminal Psychology, it's held that, in Australia, about 15% of cases are unsolved in the same year they are reported, and that's annually. While such investigations officially remain open and occasionally readdressed, as in when a 50th anniversary without answers approaches, for the most part, often courtesy of lack of funding and manpower, they're left lie unless something compelling is produced to again kick them back into the glare of the spotlight. When it comes to Karen, one of the scant, inarguable facts is that what was described as a new lead became public in June 1972, close to a year and a half after she vanished, her body found nearly 11 weeks later in the forested area next door to the Canberra airport. ACT police confidently stated they'd spoken with a local woman who could potentially assist establish the identity of a man possibly involved. According to my source, the suggestion is that this may have come about as a result of an overheard conversation in a place of business about Karen and what she may have suffered. It's not difficult to imagine Canberrans pausing over their breakfasts, newspapers spread before them, exchanging hopeful comments on what looked to be a fairly major breakthrough. Next, virtual silence. The only other reference before the year ended, a small front-page article of the Canberra Times mentioning that the reward for anything leading to a conviction was to be lifted from $2,000 to $10,000. This was a hefty jump. In 2021 terms, according to the Reserve Bank of Australia inflation calculator, approximately $22,000 to more than $110,000. Such a tactic can, so I've been told, be employed to prod anyone providing or considering providing anything of value to investigators, a gold-tinged carrot, if you will, to keep them talking. It would be almost another year, though, before any of it was again addressed, at least publicly. Out of the blue, on October 17, 1973, the Canberra Times reported that Inspector Reg Kennedy attested that over the previous 2 months, he'd twice questioned a man, aged about 30, thought to be involved in the death of Miss Rowland. As attributed to Inspector Kennedy, police are reasonably satisfied the person we have interviewed has some very definite knowledge of the girl's disappearance and subsequent death, but there is insufficient evidence at this stage, and because of certain circumstances, no charges are being proffered. Nothing further eventuated. No names, explanations, or reasons for or behind any of it, or arrests. What gave the appearance of one of the most concrete leads in the saga seemed to vanish into yet another black hole. Now it's been acknowledged by both the AFP and others close to the investigation that a party identified to them may have crossed paths with Keren, either when she was at the Canberra show on the evening she went missing, or when she was stranded on Parkes Way after her car ran out of fuel. These were among details allegedly proffered by a Canberra-based labourer working in the region, who just over a year after Keren's body was discovered, beat another man to death with a log. He'd be charged in early June 1972. In attempting to iron out a somewhat bumpy timeline, it was a matter of weeks later the ACT police made their declaration of the woman assisting them in their inquiries about a man associated in some way. The labourer, also believed to be a boxer, was found guilty in February 1973 of having bundled a Sydney man into the boot of his car and, on taking him to a remote location, bludgeoned him about the head. The attack was claimed to be fueled by the victim having propositioned his killer. On asked if he had anything to say before his sentence was handed down, the perpetrator claimed, "I did not mean to kill him, Your Honour." In accordance with Inspector Kennedy's statements of the time, what was purportedly admitted to in relation to Keren was seemingly quite in depth. In addition, it appeared to include particulars then barely touched upon or not previously made public at all. It's also said to have addressed the assumption that, rather than premeditated murder, Keren's death may have been the result of a violent struggle when she attempted to escape the clutches of an abductor. More specifically, that she may have been struck in order to be subdued. This prospect dovetails with another outcome of the inquest, as it turns out, one that I'd already outlined for inclusion in the forthcoming Episode 6. Then there's the fact it harks to Coroner Kevin Dobson's official pronouncement in his open finding that his mind tended towards murder or foul play, leaving open the door that it may not have been intentional homicide. Other expressed specifics were in relation to the location of Keren's body, so too the positioning of items found with her. Of these, brief mentions only featured in Canberra and Sydney newspapers shortly after her remains were discovered. On October 2, 1971, the Canberra Times, in providing an overview of the proceedings, detailed, "There was a very strong suggestion that the body had been dragged to the position in which it had been found because of the finding of a biro, shoes, handbag, and pantyhose portions in an approximate straight line from the body to a nearby track." And that was the extent of it. Other minimal references also surfaced after the inquest, relayed as being alluded to in the confession, including that a car similar to the one Miss Keren Rowland had been driving was seen to turn a semicircle on the roundabout at the intersection of Parkes Way and Anzac Parade and continue back along Parkes Way. This is in stark contrast to recent pronouncements in certain quarters of the media that the route taken after Keren accepted a lift was up Anzac Parade to its top, overlooked by the Australian War Memorial, and a right turn taken at that roundabout. As to how Keren died, the possibility of strangulation was pointed to in both the Canberra Times and the Sydney Morning Herald. The only offering then as to why this had been a consideration was the presence of the faint pinkish tinge to her teeth, as discussed in episode 4 of this podcast, and in the absence of any other visible trauma to the skeleton inflicted by bullets or a knife. In other words, despite the magnitude of the crime for the still small city and what was described as extensive media coverage, not much was revealed in terms of the minute particulars. To be abreast of all of that, you'd have to have been paying very close attention to what seems relatively scarce information. The only other way to have known about it would have required someone to be present at the coronial inquest. Why, though, would anyone willingly admit to such things, or potentially blame another for it? Indeed, among all this additionally generated speculation, so is there a murky implication of a second person of interest connected to the prisoner also held to similarly be deserving of follow-up. Enmity, rivalry, hate, Each and all of these elements may have played a role in the dark happenings that unfurled. Perhaps even more importantly, questions of what and how much was done to confirm or eliminate any of it as plausible. Of course, the coronial inquest was done, its findings not of a nature substantial enough to allow more vigorous pursuit. Without any hard evidence or a primary suspect, there's no chance to go to trial. And so that was apparently the end of that. As it transpired, the still unsolved case of Karen Rowland didn't appear to again receive a single publicised mention until the fifth anniversary of her disappearance, marked by a 16-paragraph, page 7 article in the Canberra Times of February 27, 1976. Almost a month after that, a déjà vu headline, New Leads. The police received two separate calls declared similar in detail. Each was said to actually describe a man seen in the area Karen's car was abandoned back in 1971. If a description or identikit, that a concept introduced in the US in 1959 and enhanced in the UK with the use of photos from 1970, was ever made available, there's no reference. Nor if said description fitted any of what the modern AFP has confirmed was a lengthy list of persons of interest. Unsurprisingly, the original detectives had long been reassigned, comprehensive and informed views and knowledge ebbing away. In terms of what remained on file, come 2020 when it was again reactivated, it would be revealed that, along with evidence such as Karen's belongings being unable to be accounted for, there wasn't even a fully defined explanation of where her body had been found. On questioning the AFP about these earlier happenings, the response is that preliminary re-examinations of all available material suggest that at least one of the persons of interest to feature in this newest development had, in their explanation, two pretty strong alibis. The only revealed specifics at this juncture is that they involved others who stuck to it, saying we were with him all night and were able to account for his movements. It's also suggested that the man at the centre of it may have wanted nothing more than a few days out of prison. Sources state he'd been released to the custody of Canberra police officers to allow formal interviews to be conducted. Nonetheless, AFP detectives have nominated that, despite being unable to produce anything that could be acted upon back then, given the chance of involvement of someone who, in their words, ticks quite a few boxes, he remains on the list of people we would like to speak with in time. On my following up with many of those well acquainted with proceedings, it's felt there's more than enough holes in relation to this aspect of the case to be deserving of a longer and harder look. It may also be a last opportunity to do so given that time is running out for real answers to be uncovered in this ongoing mystery. To be blunt, it must be now that the seeming shroud of secrecy that descended over all so early is thrown off in order that it doesn't continue to muffle and distort the little that's known or what might be known. Otherwise, it may well be never. All of this and other questions inevitably arising as a result will be further explored in upcoming episodes in this podcast. For me, now it's back to more research and investigation in order to bring you the next instalment, refocusing on the other unexplained or unaccounted for elements that virtually confirm the presence of some shadowy other, and if they too fit with this most recent development. Thanks for listening, and also to those who continue to reach out to me with information, details, and potentially evidence. Also to those involved helping bringing all this together, both production-wise and in their support. In keeping up with all that continues to evolve, you can also follow Capital Crime Files on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And if you have any questions or comments, please feel free to post them.